You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. I don't know who first said there's more than one way to skin a cat, or for that matter, why anyone would want to skin a cat, but it could have easily been my guest today, cartoonist and scientist Randall Munroe. The number one best-selling author and creator of the webcomic XKCD is used to his fans asking him questions that usually begin with what if or how can I, and he responds with outlandish but thoroughly researched and scientifically sound answers for how to accomplish just about anything. Now he's taking it to the next level with a book that finds complex solutions to everyday tasks. It's called How To: Absurd Scientific Advice for Common Real-World Problems. And today, Randall joins me on the show to explain how to use elaborate scientific theories to do everything from sending a package to moving a house. He discusses how he went from being a NASA physicist to a cartoonist on the web, and he says there are actually a surprising number of physicists turned cartoonists. In fact, there are a surprising number of physicists turned cartoonists who share his birthday. Randall reveals the biggest hurdle to building a molten lava moat around your home, how to throw a coin or just about anything across a river, and how Serena Williams takes down a drone. Plus, fishing with electricity, why scientists still haven't figured out how ice works, and why the U.S. military once nuked a bunch of beer cans. Coming up with Randall Munroe in just a moment.
The actual study on this before I can cite it in something, because I remember reading about it a long time ago. There was a military study of soldiers in desert conditions, and they were saying that they, you know, are constantly having trouble supplying enough water. And so they wanted to try, they found that if they cut water rations in half, all the soldiers got dehydrated. That's the problem.
Yeah.
But if they did another study, they tried over the same period just slowly tapering the water rations to the same level, but giving them like a week at every reduced level. By the end of it, the soldiers still got exactly as dehydrated, because you can't like learn to not need water.
Yeah.
You know, so it was like, you need a certain amount of water, and there's no like trick to, you know, well, if you do this, you can get by with, you know, it's like, your body needs water. You can't science your way out of that one.
Well, let's tell the folks who you are. This is Randall Munroe. He is a former NASA roboticist who left the agency in 2006 to draw comics on the internet full time. He's the author of the number one New York Times bestseller, What If? And Thing Explainer, and the creator of the science question and answer blog, What If? And the popular webcomic, XKCD. Now he's written a new book described as the world's most entertaining and useless self-help guide. It's titled How To: Absurd Scientific Advice for Common Real-World Problems. Randall Munroe, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, I really enjoyed the book, and I'm also a fan of your website, XKCD.
Oh, thank you.
Where you post, I'm trying to think how to describe them. They're usually scientifically inspired cartoons. And I think just to give people a sample of your humor, here's a cartoon that I found on the site today. It's called Foucault Pendulum. I don't know if you remember that one.
Mm-hmm.
And admittedly, a podcast is, you know, an auditory medium is not the best platform for a cartoon.
Mm-hmm.
But the first panel presumably takes place in a science museum. And you have one of those Foucault pendulums, which people probably know as the pendulum that knocks down the little pegs.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, I guess, a museum docent or something is taking a tour group through and says, this Foucault pendulum demonstrates Earth's rotation. It stays in a fixed plane where the Earth rotates under it. And then one of the visitors thinks to himself, Really? So that means, and then he runs in and grabs the pendulum and stops it. We then cut to the last panel of a newscaster. Yeah. Says the Earth's rotation was briefly halted today until geophysicists wrestled the intruder to the ground. So that's the kind of stuff that we're dealing with here. Now, you actually do have a background in science, right? You started out as a physicist.
Yeah, I did a degree in physics at Christopher Newport University in Virginia, an undergraduate degree. And then from there, I started working on robots at the nearby NASA Langley Research Center.
Wow, that's pretty cool. Was that a fun job?
Oh, yeah, for sure. It was really fun. I started out with a summer internship, which I think I found a flyer for it. And, you know, I wasn't always the greatest student, so I was like, oh, this is probably a thing I'm not qualified for. Yeah. And I think it turned out literally no one else from my college applied.
Really?
So, you know, that's a life tip. You never know. Apply for random stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't think NASA still used flyers for recruiting.
Yeah, no, it was interesting. up in the engineering and physics department.
Oh, funny. Now, what led you to quit that and go into cartoons?
Well, it was sort of an accident. And it was also, you know, NASA kind of helped me a little bit. I don't know if – so I was working on a contract basis, and I had to, like, convince them to give me a new contract, you know, every like 90 days, they would be like re-upping my contract for the project I was working on.
Okay.
And so then when the funding for that project, you know, they were like, we're gonna stop doing this contract. We can find you a new one if you want. And right around that time, I had been drawing comics online, and people had started wanting to buy T-shirts, and at first, I just shipped a few T-shirts, and then suddenly there were a whole lot of orders. And so I was spending a lot of my time when I wasn't working at this lab just like buying and folding and organizing T-shirts and handling PayPal, you know, and orders. And then I realized, like, wow, I might be making more money if I stay home at this point.
Really? Off of T-shirts?
Yeah, it was
you don't
really
license
lucky.
Your cartoons, right?
No, I mean—
You don't syndicate them.
No, the news— right. Well, so I grew up reading things like Calvin and Hobbes and, you know, The Far Side, and those were big influences in me. But I knew about, like, the fights that they would have with the syndicates and how, like, you know, Bill Watterson famously, the author of Calvin and Hobbes, had, like, long fights with the syndicates over licensing and merchandising, and he had very strong principles about, you know, I feel like people in comics really admired him for, you know, standing up and having that fight, but also, like, the fact that he had to have that fight made newspaper cartooning sound like, oh, wow. You know, like, he shopped his comics around for 5 years before he found someone who would put them in newspapers. So, but the internet, you can just put stuff there. No one can stop you. So it seemed way easier.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's still how it works in most cases. And that's how cartoonists make money. You said that you did this because you thought it was a good business decision to put it out there for free. Explain that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
How
well,
does that work?
You know, I feel like nowadays, that's an easier sell for people. The idea that the best marketing is sort of word of mouth, that you can't. And so now people put a lot of effort into, like, making things that are going to go viral. And I think when I started doing this at about, you know, in 2005 and 2006, and people were asking, like, wait, why are all these people, you know, reading your website? I don't think I had a term for that. I don't think the term going viral.
Maybe you invented the term.
No, definitely. No, but because I remember trying to explain, it's like, I didn't buy ads anywhere. But, like, if someone likes something and they send it to someone else and then everyone sort of does that, it can grow really fast. So instead of having to, like, shop it around for 5 years, I went from, like, posting comics online to, like, doing comics full time you know, in under a year.
And which, this was before social media really caught on and that kind of thing. Were they emailing?
Yeah, no, I mean, there were all kinds of places people hung out online, all kinds of forums, chat rooms. Yeah,
forums.
I mean, the era of AOL Instant Messenger, I was making that. But it was, a lot of it was just being in the right place at the right time. You know, like, I was just really lucky. I was doing comics about stuff that people were looking for comics about right then, you know. And, so, like, I don't know. People are like, what should I do, you know, if I want to be successful at doing, you know, any kind of web publishing thing? I'm like, oh, man, I don't know. I just feel like I got so fortunate in where I was, what I was doing, when I was doing it, and, like, that seemed like such a big part of it.
Yeah, and apparently you now have your own wiki for XKCD, where, you know, there's a whole fan culture of people trying to explain your cartoons, and in some cases even trying to speculate about their creator. Do you have any favorite fan theories about yourself?
No. I actually try to steer clear of most of that.
That's smart.
Because, I don't know, I think it's really easy to kind of like get hooked into responding to things.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, it might be like, I want to correct this particular person. But like, there are too many people on the internet to do that.
Yeah.
Early on, I did a comic about making fun of the urge to stay up late at night and not go to bed because someone's wrong on the internet and you have to prove them right. And I partly did this comic to kind of like remind myself, like, sometimes you should just leave the internet alone, let it do its thing.
Yeah.
And the nice thing about doing that was that comic, I was sort of setting a trap for myself. Because if I started to get too mad at something online and like argue with someone, then someone else could be like, hey, you know, there's this great comic about how dumb it is to do that. Have you seen this? It's called Excuse. And like, nothing takes the wind out of your sails like having someone quote your own comic to you to prove that you're wrong.
Yeah, it's interesting because we're living in this time where science is just getting so politicized and so confrontational, and in some instances, maybe rightly so, because we are facing some serious problems that we have to tackle, and some people just want to bury their heads in the sand. But you generally avoid being too preachy about science and getting into those arguments. Instead, usually opt to let your work speak for itself. It makes me think of the cartoon that you did, the wonderful infographic about the history of global warming.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's a better way for science to win over hearts and minds? Or mostly minds. I guess we're going for minds. But
well, I mean, I don't know if... There's a great climate scientist, Catherine Hayhoe, who talks about how really the way to reach someone's mind is first to, to reach them through the heart, and then that opens them up to you. There's a Lincoln quote about that too. I don't know the right way to do all this stuff. But one thing that I think is really pretty true and sometimes hard to follow is that like, it's never good to be to get too kind of preachy at people because no one likes being condescended to.
Sure.
And people can really tell when you're doing that, even if you're like trying to mask it.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I try to do is, instead of like yelling at people or telling them like, you're doing this and that's, you know, wrong, and if you think it's a good idea, you're a bad person or whatever. And instead, like, try to talk about like, here are the things that I find exciting and surprising and interesting, and try to share those with people in a way that will help them feel the same way.
Yeah. Is there something about the way a physicist views the world that lends itself to the kind of humor in your cartoons, kind of wry, almost Gary Larson-esque humor?
I don't know. Maybe. It does seem like, and maybe this is just because I know, you know, I notice it, but it does seem like there are sort of a weirdly large number of people with physics degrees who then go on into a cartooning career.
Really? Is that true? Like,
who? Yeah. I mean, there's another webcomic, a guy who does, you know, a lot of sort of similar stuff. He's a great guy. We're friends. Zach Wiener-Smith. He does Saturday morning breakfast cereal. Bill Amond, the author of Foxtrot, which I, you know, grew up reading. He's a great guy, also a physics degree.
Huh.
And in fact, one of my favorite pieces of trivia is that of all of the cartoonists who started off with a physics degree before going into cartoons and, you know, and who had a lot of readers who were like engineers you know, technical people, but also like young people. Of all of those cartoonists, of the ones who were born on October 17th, I think I'm the second most successful.
What?
because the
who's the first?
Because Mike Judge, who did Beavis and Butthead, and also Office Space. Yeah, he's got a physics degree.
Oh my
There's
god!
A lot
I
of
never
us.
Knew
I don't
that.
Know.
Wow.
I don't know how this. I don't know. So maybe I think
that's hilarious.
I feel like I really like I get along with people who did physics for the most part. I think because there is a kind of mindset of you got to be like. A little bit too like head in the clouds to be a good engineer almost.
Yeah.
Like you're always like, okay, well, what if we make this situation more general and idealized and try to find an overall theory that explains it all, even if it's not like useful for the specific thing. But then like, if you go too far in that direction, you go into like pure mathematics and you start doing like algebraic geometry or something, which has like like nothing to do with anything. Yeah. I'm not to insult any algebraic geometrists out there, but like, so it's people who like wobble back and forth between the practical and the theoretical. Mm-hmm. So maybe there's something to that.
Yeah. Now, I imagine that you would probably be the first to admit that you're no Michelangelo. Your cartoons are famously simplistic. I mean, they're basically stick figures.
Oh yeah. I mean, someone asked me just yesterday about. How did you develop your stick figure drawing style? And I was like, it's not so much that I developed it, it's that I never developed anything else. Like, I started off doing stick figures.
I wonder, do you think that works in your favor? Because now, yeah, I guess the art is less distracting from the idea behind the comics.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the cool things about comics is that they let you kind of simplify and cut out the stuff that's not... you know, not as relevant. And I mean, there's this Scott McCloud quote about how when you look at a photo or a realistic drawing, you see of a face, you see someone else. But if you look at like an icon of a face, you see yourself. You know, it's easier to put yourself in their shoes.
Right.
And I think that simplicity can really be a good thing. I mean, but it's also like, I sure hope it can be a good thing because that's what I've learned to draw. But no, I like the comics I grew up reading. You know, I draw these simple stick figures, but like, and so it's like, oh, it's just a few lines. But then like, I look at like Peanuts, you know, the Charles Schulz strip, and the number of lines in those strips is like not that, it's like so few of them. He just knew exactly where to put them. And that's really impressive.
Yeah. Who were the cartoonists that you grew up admiring? I mean, you mentioned Calvin and Hobbes.
Yeah. Well, I feel like that's the big one. That was, you know, I was just at the right age. That was the first comic I ever read. I remember pulling a book off a shelf and being like, oh, what's this? And flipping it open and trying to understand the panels, you know.
Yeah, me too. I think it was one of the first of that. And Far Side, I think I read some of the old Peanuts cartoons.
Far Side's great. Yeah. No, I read, you know, but I just read everything in the library under that comics section. You know, I never read any of the like Marvel and DC kinds of comics. I never, and the Japanese comics, you know, a lot of cartoonist friends grew up, you know, reading those. But for me, it was mostly, I mostly read newspaper comics.
Before we get to the book, I have to ask, what is XKCD? Is that an inside joke or something?
No, I noticed early on with the internet that you have to pick usernames. And I started out using AOL in 1993 when my family got an account, and I had to pick a name. And so I was like picking names based on whatever I was interested in at the time. So for a while, I would like use the username Skywalker4. And then I got really into the end. You know, there were three other people who had
wanted to be
Skywalker.
I mean, that's amazing that you were number four.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, there were people who got all kinds of... I was then Animorph7, and I did a few other, you know... But like every time I like got into a new book series or a new like thing that I was excited about and wanted to... I would pick a new name. But then I realized that's starting to get confusing because you got to make names on a couple of different places.
Yeah.
And I would try to pick a name that sounded cool, but then a few years later, like something that sounds cool to an 11-year-old does not sound cool to a 16-year-old, you know, and then it continues like this. So I was
that
like, you know,
must have frustrated your friends.
Well, exactly. That's the thing. But I don't want to change my name because they all know, you know, how to reach me that way. So I realized when I was a teenager, I was like, wait, if we got to pick names for things, I might be stuck with this for a really long time. I want something that doesn't have any meaning that I'm going to get tired of. And that's really short because I'm going to be typing it on a bunch of places, and it'll be cool to have like a short username because you know if everyone they run out really quick, you know. Yep. And I decided I wanted something that like it would just be a string of letters, and it wouldn't look like it was trying to. It wasn't a word. It wasn't an acronym. It wasn't something you're supposed to pronounce. And then I wanted to make sure not to include any letters that would be ambiguous if you wrote them like lowercase or up. So like no I's because they look like capital I and lowercase
that's
L.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
No O's because they can look like zeros. But then of the remaining letters, then I just like tried to find a combination that I could like take as mine. And that would be like my spot in the space of all strings of text.
And in addition to XKCD, you also have this fun blog called What If, where you answer questions such as, how long would it take to slide down a fireman's pole from the moon to the earth? Is that kind of where you got some of the ideas for your new book, How To?
Yeah, I was really surprised when I started doing comics that people would write in with their questions for me to answer, like science questions. But they always sort of said, like, me and my friend have been having an argument about this, but it seemed like too ridiculous to bother a real scientist about. So we figured we'd write to you instead. And I would have so much fun answering them because when someone asks a cool question like that, and like if I think I know a way to get to the answer, For me, it's like getting a song stuck in your head. Like I'll like stop whatever I'm doing and then just like work on that for like end up like 6 hours of reading.
Yeah, that's quite a rabbit hole.
Yeah, and I have so much fun with that that I started like saying, hey, if I'm gonna write, if I'm gonna do 6 hours of research, I might as well like post it somewhere for someone to read and see if people like it. And then found that that people had a lot of questions and that I had so much fun answering them that I found that it was a really good way to explain cool science ideas by taking some simple sounding practical problem or question and then trying to work through it. And that's what I did with What If, and that's also what I did sort of from another direction with How To.
Yeah, How To is sort of the opposite of your last book, which was Thing Explainer, in which you, I think, took the 1,000 most common words in the English language and used them to explain incredibly complex concepts. How To, on the other hand, kind of flips that on its head, and you take generally simple tasks like taking a selfie, sending a message, and that kind of thing, and you find more and more absurd and elaborate ways to accomplish these things. It's sort of a Rube Goldberg type thing, huh?
Yeah, I'm always good at coming up with ideas for solving some problem that I'm convinced will, like, in the long run, this will save time once we get it working, even though it seems complicated now. And it, like, always ends up taking more time than the original, like, the normal way would. But yeah, I with this, I tried to think, okay, I'm going to take these simple tasks and try to think outside the box. Think of, like, the weird ways you might try to do it. And then figure out whether they're really a bad idea or not. Yeah. And, like, they're almost always bad ideas. But sometimes it surprises you, or sometimes you find that something you thought was a bad idea has actually been tried or might actually work.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Randall Monroe when we come back in just a minute. Imagine yourself with a doctoral degree at the top of your field, teaching, researching, or making a bigger impact in your community. A doctorate is a huge step forward to achieving your goals. So what's stopping you? A doctoral degree may seem out of reach because of the investment involved, be it a time investment or a financial one. But you could earn your degree from Capella University through their flexible program with online classes and a dedicated community of faculty and students just like you. If you're worried about the cost of your degree, Capella is there to help too. Eligible new students enrolling in select doctoral programs may qualify for a $5,000 or $10,000 scholarship. In addition to scholarships, Capella has a team of financial aid counselors, enrollment counselors, and career counselors to help you make your goals a reality. Because you are an investment that's worth it. Learn more about the support and resources you'll have from beginning to end. You can also start by exploring Capella's programs and scholarship opportunities at capella.edu/kick. And now, back to the show. A lot of these ideas sound ridiculous, but sometimes I guess you really never know till you try. I mean, a lot of scientific discoveries and inventions probably sounded ludicrous at the time until someone actually thought a little deeper on the problem and just decided not to accept that something was inherently impossible.
Yeah, or just tried something ridiculous just to see what
curiosity.
Would happen. Yeah. I mean, like, antibiotics have, like, revolutionized medicine.
Yeah.
But, like, if you told someone, I'm going to take this mold and then I'm going to smear it on this cut that I got, you know, like, that definitely sounds like a bad idea.
Yeah, yeah, no
but then,
kidding.
Like, at the same time, there's lots of stuff you could smear on your on cuts. And, like, most of it won't be antibiotics. You know, it's not like every bad idea is actually good.
Yeah.
But that's what I like about science, is it lets you kind of figure out which ideas are good and bad, sometimes before you've had to try them through, you know, calculation and theory and research.
Can you give us some kind of an example of a task that could be done pretty easily by the simplest, most immediate way, but could also be done with these super over-the-top complex solutions, of course, with the aid of science and perhaps an unlimited budget, I guess.
Yeah, I was thinking about how frustrating it is to move, to pack stuff into boxes.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, you
for
know,
sure.
everyone, like, there's the sort of the standard way to move where you get some kind of a moving vehicle, get a bunch of cardboard boxes, you put the stuff in the cardboard boxes, carry them out, and it always ends up taking like 10 times longer than you expect, and it's so exhausting and derails your whole life. It's really, I'm not a fan of moving. But I was thinking, is there a way to avoid some of these steps, like packing? So like I have to take all the stuff out of my house, but then put it into boxes. But it's sort of already in a box. It's in this house-shaped box. And like,
true.
What if instead of like getting a new house and selling the old house, you just pick up the house and move it? And like, that's not totally off out of the question because, you know, people do move houses. You see them sometimes on those big flatbed trucks. Usually, I think they do take the stuff out of the house before they do that. But I was thinking, could you just lift up the house with everything inside, move it to the new place, and then put it down? So I started researching, like, how do you lift a house? And I learned that you can't just, like, you know, put like hooks under the edges and lift up because a house is like a mattress. If you lift like one corner of it, just that corner will come up.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And so so you got to put like girders underneath the house and to support it.
Yeah.
But then you got to detach it from the foundation. But you really can then lift it and put it on a truck. But then as I'm researching this and I was talking to some friends, one of my friends, she used to work at the at a permitting office for where they gave out the wide load permits for those trucks that you see on the highway.
Okay, is that DMV or who?
You know, I'm not sure it was. Like well, that. what she said was that people didn't realize in her particular jurisdiction was that, you know, in her state, you had to get a permit for every jurisdiction you're going to pass through separately.
Oh, yeah, I didn't even think about that.
And she said that people who came into her office never knew that, and they would always get like. It would become a huge headache because they're like, oh, I didn't realize we were going to have to do this. It's too late now. You know, I've got to. And so I was thinking you've got that problem. And then you also got bridges over the road.
Oh, yeah.
And I was thinking about that jurisdiction question of like you're going to pass through all these different towns. And then I realized, you know, up above all the towns are the different classes of airspace.
Oh, right.
And airplanes don't have to get permits to pass through towns.
True.
They're all under the jurisdiction of the FAA. So it got me thinking, could I skip that whole permit process by lifting the house up into the air, flying it sideways, and then coming back down? And then it's like, so obviously that's not a good way to move. You know, I was like, I know that.
Yeah, well, you can't do that with an ordinary helicopter.
Well, that's what I was thinking though. I was like, okay, that's not a good way to move. But if you wanted to, could you? And that I couldn't rest until I knew the answer. And so I found out about these. I went and looked at like heavy lift helicopters to see. If they could lift a house, and like they couldn't lift the house I grew up in, it was too heavy. But then I was thinking, well, you know, it's not that much heavier than their capacity. So if you got two or three or four helicopters, they could all lift it pulling together.
Okay.
But then I was thinking, well, okay, you got a whole bunch of helicopters attached to cables pulling on
separately,
your house.
Yeah.
Like it's like a handful of balloons on strings.
Yeah.
So you got to keep the helicopters.
It's like being drawn and quartered.
Yeah. And that's like, well, you have to keep the helicopters from colliding with each other, but they all have to kind of go upward. And then I thought, okay, well, what if you attach them all together into one giant helicopter with like rigid things so that their blades are far enough apart they don't collide? And then they could lift together. And then I started to feel like, okay, This has gotten too impractical. I've gone too far down this rabbit hole. And then I discovered, not because I was thinking it still probably would work to attach them together, but just as I was going to like, okay, I'm going to give up on that thread. I think that's too ridiculous. I found that there was a government project in the 1970s called like the multi-helicopter heavy lift system that was like exactly what I described. They were like, let's take two helicopters, chop the tail off of one of them and bolt them together and get that to lift something. And this project, there's a 150-page report on it where they go over all the details. And that one ended up not getting funded. Although I just learned.
Yeah.
And so I wrote about this and I said, this may sound like a ridiculous idea, but the U.S. government has actually studied this. There was a study commissioned from this helicopter company to build one of these. So maybe this idea isn't as ridiculous as I thought. On the other hand, it never got funded, so maybe it was.
I mean, it seems like there are very few absurd things in a book like this that haven't at one point been thought of by the U.S. military.
Yeah, the Cold War was a weird time. Let me tell you. There was a whole series of nuclear tests where they bought packaged soda and beer from a local convenience store and then put it at a test site and set off nuclear weapons over it just to see if it would survive and be drinkable afterwards.
Yeah. Wow.
It was a wild time.
Yeah.
I feel like if you get deep enough into any field, you start to find weird stuff like that. The way that fisheries researchers, they have the thing called electrofishing where they stick some electrodes in the water and just like jolt the water with electricity and it stuns the fish and they float to the surface and then they can count them.
Yeah.
And like that's actually like how they do it. It's a useful tool for fisheries surveying stuff. But it's
they just kill the fish?
No, if they turn the dial up too far, yeah.
Oh, okay. I thought they try to stun them
and they kind of float up and they can see them. And you know, it's called electrofishing. But it and like it is useful. And I've read a bunch of papers by fisheries researchers who talk about, you know, the pros and cons of it and how it works and, you know, what kinds of fish you need what current for. But it like it really, if someone described that to you and you didn't know it was a real thing, it sounds like an idea that was come up with by a little kid who doesn't understand electricity. Like, I'm going to just take this toaster and drop it in the water and that'll zap all the fish and then I can save time with the fishing rod. You know, like, no, that's not how that works. But it turns out it is how it works. I love that kind of thing.
Yes. And some of these are just straight up Bond villain type stuff because there's one chapter here on how to build a lava moat around your house. What's the biggest hurdle there? Is it I initially assumed that it would be how do you keep the lava molten because it's constantly cooling, isn't it, when it's exposed to the air? Or cooling the house. I mean, that's another issue.
I mean the lava lava puts out a lot of heat. And so I actually had a friend who had ants coming into his house, and he was really frustrated about them because it's hard to get rid of them. And then he lived out in the woods, and he was like, I can't, you know, they're always coming in from the all around, but I can. Would it cost too much if I just wanted to put a moat of molten lava around my house? And so I started trying to calculate the cost for him. The big problem is heat loss off of the lava. Mm-hmm. So you've got to supply enough heat to keep it molten. It's not just getting the lava there. It's like it's going to cool really quickly.
Yeah.
You know, a red hot stove, you turn off the stove, it stops being red hot pretty fast.
Yeah.
So soon the lava will cool down and you'll just have kind of a weird lumpy sidewalk. And so you got to keep supplying heat through some kind of heating mechanism. So if you figure out the heat, it's like there are papers on surveying lava flows, and it says how much heat flows off per square, you know, square meter, square foot, square whatever of lava. And you can just take that and you got to supply that much heat from the bottom to keep it balanced. You know, it's like a conservation thing. And so you just look up the price of gas heat, the price of electricity, and do some simple division. And so he texted me about this, and so I texted him back. Okay, I found a paper on this. It looks like for the house you're talking about, that's going to be about $25,000 a day.
Okay, I mean there are certain tech tycoons who could actually afford that.
Yeah, it was definitely outside my friend's price range, but but it's also I was surprised by how low that was. You know, I was thinking it was going to be a lot more, but it's like there are a lot of people who could afford that, and some of them do kind of seem like the lava moat types. So
I think Elon Musk would totally go for a lava moat.
Yeah. What honestly the hurdle that I was kind of curious about, I didn't ever get a straight answer because this also varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. But if I go out and try to build a lava moat in my around my house, like definitely a bunch of authorities are going to be unhappy about that. Like no question.
Yeah.
At the very least, like whoever comes to read the meter is going to be like a little frustrated. You know, the FedEx people trying to deliver packages. But who would like actually tell you had to stop first? Who actually has jurisdiction over that? You know, is it the fire department? Like they maybe be called in to put out
sense.
The lava moat, but like. Do they actually, you know, is it against the fire code? You know, is it against is it the zoning board? Or would it just be like the mayor would just show up and be like, come on.
You might be able to get away with that. You just say, look, show me where it's not
There's no rule in the books that says you can't have a lava moat. There's nothing that says a dog can't play basketball.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of Air Bud theories of law.
Well, speaking of that, there's a chapter in here on how to stop a drone using sports equipment. Apparently, a lot of government agencies still haven't really figured out the best way to catch a drone if it has explosives attached. You got a little bit of help from, of all people, Serena Williams. How'd you get her to test that out, and how'd she do?
Oh, well, as usual, it started with I was going down a research rabbit hole because I was looking at, you know, there are all these different ways to you know, catch drones that people have tried. Some of them are better than others. But I started thinking about, like, if you got one of those wedding photography drones floating over your yard and you don't have a fancy anti-drone piece of equipment and you're just going to, like, throw stuff at it, like, what's the best thing to throw? And I started comparing all these different pieces of sports equipment to see how accurate they'd be. And there are a lot of studies in sports medicine and sports physiology about the accuracy of pro players in different sports. Mm-hmm. And so I got to compare, like, is a baseball better than a basketball? And I could do that by like looking at free throw percentages in basketball and the range to the basket versus like the spread of a pitcher in baseball because they've got all the strike measurement stuff. Mm-hmm. And then in some other sports, they don't have as much data from the play, but there are studies where they'll have pro players just like kick a soccer ball at a target on the wall and measure like the distribution of where it hits.
So you had a lot of data.
Yeah, I had all this data, and so I was plugging it in to make this model, but I couldn't find good data on tennis players. And like, it might be out there, but I couldn't find I was like in the middle of like searching for a paper on tennis players hitting balls at targets that were up on the wall. There was one on hitting at the target on the ground, a couple others, but I wanted to, you know, something that would be good for the model for shooting at a drone. Mm-hmm. And I had texted way back like 10 years ago with Serena Williams' husband, cause he helped with when I published my first comic collection.
No kidding.
Alexis Ohanian. I'm in touch once in a while, and he had texted me about something, and I said, you know, it's funny. Funny you should text. I'm in the middle of like reading a whole bunch of papers on tennis player accuracy for this book I'm working on. And he texted back, well, oh hey, if there's any way we can help out, let me know. You know, send us a message. So I was like, well, you don't turn down an opportunity like that, you know. So I was like, I asked Serena if she would be willing to, like, I knew she's super busy, so I didn't want to like impose, and I was just happy that they were going to contribute some data. So I asked if she could, if she would be willing, like when she's going down to practice or something, to just stick something to a wall, like a target, like a piece of masking tape, whatever, and then stand some distance away and serve a bunch of tennis balls at it, trying to hit it as close as she could. And if they can just, even if they just videotape the balls hitting the wall in some way where, you know, I can see on the video how far away it was, you know, maybe take a photo with a ruler up there, I would do all the work of like figuring out what, you know, the accuracy and all, figuring out modeling all that stuff. And then I could use that to plug it into my model and figure out how hard it would be for her to hit different drone models. And so I sent that, but I was trying to make it as simple as possible, you know, as a little out of the way, a little extra work for them as possible. But it turned out she was like, "Do you want me to just hit a drone?" and I was like, "Oh, sure, yeah." And so they had a drone that had a broken camera that they had been playing with. You know, that was her husband's old drone that he had gotten. And so it was already damaged, but it was a fancy drone. You know, and they had it fly up over the court. And then she stood down by the baseline and served at it to try to knock it out of the air.
Wow.
And yeah, I had come up with like a preliminary model, you know, a model of like, oh, I looked at other players that hit things with and a few tennis studies where I tried to apply them to drones. And it suggested that a pro player, champion player should take, my guess was like maybe 5 to 7 serves to hit that model at that distance. Mm-hmm. And she missed the first two, just missed, and the third one nailed it and
really
knocked it out of the air.
Wow!
So she
actually took it out.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. She clipped one of the four wing, you know, propeller things, and disintegrated. The propeller just kind of disintegrated and it flipped
incredible.
Over. But
what a serve!
Yeah, yeah. And I don't know. So she did better than my model suggested, but that could just be a statistical outlier. But I sort of think it's a Serena Williams outlier.
Yeah. Now, did you attempt any of these experiments yourself?
Not really. I sort of feel like there's all the stuff that like is easy to test in real life. I steer away from that stuff mostly because like Mythbusters does that really well, you know, and it'll be fun.
True.
And there's a lot of YouTube videos of people trying stuff. And so I like to think about the stuff that's maybe harder or less practical to test, like attaching helicopters together.
Yeah.
Although it turns out several other people have done that too, which I'm delighted by. But yeah, I did. There was one case when I tried to come up with a model for how throwing works. You know, I wanted to do how far you can throw stuff.
It was based off of some legend about George Washington. Is
that
right?
There's a story that he threw a coin over some river, and it's one, like with a lot of these stories about George Washington, people just seem to really like telling stories about him. So it's not clear like where most of these started circulating after he had died, and people were like, oh, well, you know, I once heard he did this. So, like, sometimes the river's the Rappahannock, sometimes it's the Potomac, which he definitely couldn't have thrown something over, you know. But whatever it was, everyone agreed he was a big, strong guy who liked throwing stuff. So I was trying to think, like, how can you calculate how far you can throw something? And I was thinking about the different sports equipment and different projectiles. And I realized, and this is the physics thing talking, where you come up with a simple model because it might not be as precise, but it's still really cool that you can get answers. I just said, okay, I don't know what someone does when they throw. Some sports thing happens, you know, something athletic happens. But I know that they're going to be applying force over a certain distance to this ball to get it going from not moving to moving however fast it is when they release it. And so I looked at like the metabolic power that people are capable of putting out and then assume like they're pretty good at focusing that power on the ball somehow when they throw, you know, like people, people people seem like, you know, they always say throw with your whole body, you know, you got to have follow through. So it's like, okay, what if you just plug in, here's how much metabolic power people can output when they're doing a hard athletic activity, like rowing or something, because they got, or cycling. And it's about like for an athlete, a superb athlete, it's like 20 watts per kilogram of body weight. For a more like normal in shape amateur, it'd be more like 10.
Yeah.
And then if you just assume that power is applied over the distance that they're like the length of their body, you know, like a pitcher, your arm span's about the same as your height. So if it's like 5 feet, 6 feet, you know, you're going to apply that much power and you're going to apply it over that distance. You can work out here's how fast the ball could be going at the end of it. You know, based on how much the ball weighs and how much, you know, your size. And when I plugged that in, I plugged in that, the weight of a baseball pitcher and a baseball, and it said, you know, about 90 miles an hour. And that's, and I was like, whoa, that's actually impossible. Pretty close. You know, that's like, that's a major league fastball.
Yeah.
And then I put in a football player and the weight of a football, which is heavier, and it said like 65 miles an hour. And that was actually, it was a little high. I think the fastest football passes are more like 60. But it was still kind of like, that's about right, you know? And so I started plugging in. I was like, wait a minute. This model, the nice thing about having a really simple model is you can put anything in there. Yeah, so I was like, okay, let's put in the weight of a blender and see how far a football player could throw that. So then it was so powerful. I was like, oh, here's how far, you know, Barack Obama could throw a javelin. Here's how far I got Carly Rae Jepsen could throw a microwave 12 feet, you know? And this was so much fun. But then I was like, I want to see if this model's right before I like, it's sort of just a fun, simple model, but I want to I want to go check it. So me and my friend got a bunch of random objects, and we went out to a field and marked off distances, and we tried to see how far the two of us could throw the objects to see. And like, the equation held up pretty well.
Really? So, no kidding.
Yeah, so I've included that in my book and then put a calculator online at my website, xkcd.com/throw, where you can plug in your height and weight and figure out how far you can throw stuff.
Well, before we go, sort of along the sports line, you have this chapter on how to ski that I found very interesting. And this was one of many cases where I learned a little something in this book. You say that scientists still don't actually know how the surface of ice or snow gets slippery so that we can ski or skate.
Yeah.
That shocked me. I mean, I don't want to trot out the old, we can put a man on a moon saw, but, you know, we can build nuclear missiles. We can make a particle accelerator. How in the world do we not know how ice works by now?
Yeah. Well, I mean, maybe if putting a man on the moon involves skiing, we'd have figured like, out. We got a reason. No, and we've made some headway on the ice slipperiness.
Okay.
You know, like there have been a couple of papers recently that really nailed it down. But there was this idea that like the blade of a skate lowers the melting point of ice by a few degrees.
Yeah.
And then because it lowers the melting point by a few degrees, it drops below the temperature of the air, you know, of the skate, of the ice. And then it melts and a thin layer melts. And then that's what you're surfing on, is that layer of water. This is the theory that came up in the 1800s. And it's weird because that kind of persisted as the dominant explanation for like, you know, 50, 100 years, except that theory says that it'll melt because you lower the melting point by a couple of degrees, and then it's low enough that the ice will melt. But you can skate when it's more than a couple of degrees below freezing. It still works.
Yeah.
And the theory, that's like clearly proof that this theory is flat wrong, you know?
Funny.
No one really noticed, you know, for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure that that's the theory that I was taught in high school in science class.
So they've finally sorted it out, sort of, which is that, like, when you got a crystal of ice, most of the water molecules are locked into this grid, like, and it's like a woven, like, I think of it as sort of like a woven rug, where the threads in the middle are really hard to move because they're, like, locked in firmly. But the ones on the edge are kind of frayed, and they're not being held in as easily, so they're free to, like, flutter around a little bit. And they're more, like, free moving water molecules. So like ice will naturally form on the edge of its crystals a layer of kind of liquid, you know, or semi-liquid water. And that's the slippery part. That's what you slip on.
Interesting. Well, this was such a fun read, Randall.
Oh, I'm so glad you enjoyed it.
Again, the book is called How To, Absurd Scientific Advice for Common Real-World Problems. And I also want to tell people to check out your terrific cartoons at xkcd.com. Randall Monroe, thanks for talking with me.
Oh, no, thank you so much. This was a lot of fun.
Thanks again to Randall Monroe for coming on the podcast. Order his new book, How To, Absurd Scientific Advice for Common Real-World Problems, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. And view some of his wonderful cartoons at xkcd.com. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickassNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.